It is Monday, April 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russia rejects a British claim that it's interfering with a chemical weapons investigation in Syria. A Russian journalist dies in mysterious circumstances.
Maxim Borodin is well known in the region for his investigative reporting, focusing on the most sensitive topics, especially crime and corruption.
And we examine Western films about Russia. Are they a reflection of history or propaganda? It's all ahead. The Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog said Monday its team has not yet been able to visit the site of an alleged chemical attack last week near Syria's capital. The head of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons said Russian and Syrian officials have informed their inspectors that there are still pending security issues to be worked out before any deployment could take place to Douma. In Moscow, Russia's deputy foreign minister, Sergei Ryabkov, said the mission was not allowed in because it lacked approval from the United Nations Department for Safety and Security. UN officials in New York disputed the claim. Earlier, Russia rejected British allegations it's hindering the investigation of the alleged chemical attack and said it wants a fact-finding mission to move ahead. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow tells me about the Russian denial that it's hampering the chemical weapons probe.
Russia thinks that, first of all, these chemical weapons are a hoax to begin with, that this is somehow either terrorists on the ground or pro-Western-backed rebels or perhaps just fakery to serve Western interests. It gave essentially the U.S. and its partners a pretext to carry out these airstrikes against the government of Bashar al-Assad. So that's the beginning here. And they also say that they've always been calling for an objective investigation into this alleged chemical weapons attack. Certainly the Russian argument in terms of criticizing this attack is always really focused on the timing. They say that just as this international team from the Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons was on the ground to investigate these charges of chemical weapons use in Douma, the day before this starts, then we have these airstrikes by the U.S. and its partners. So from the very beginning, they've been insisting that this is all just fake news, and they say in terms of not providing access, they say this also is a lie.
Well, it seems interesting that Moscow is saying it wants an impartial investigation, but it seems as though this Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, that would be fairly impartial.
Right. I mean, they've broken down. The Russians have always been calling for these investigations, saying that if they actually get people on the ground to look at these issues, they'll find out that, in fact, either these charges are groundless, that there were no chemical weapons there. That's the one hand. On the other hand, they've had run into problems working with some of these international organizations. They, for example, say that this previous report that was done by the OPCW, this Chemical Weapons Investigators Unit, they say that they essentially never got down on the ground in Syria, even though the Russians were offering them access, and therefore their conclusions when they said that Bashar al-Assad had in fact used chemical weapons in the past, they called those findings essentially not true. And so this has always been a problem for them. In terms of what's happening down at Douma right now in Syria, you know, the Russians will say that they will provide access. They said they've done nothing to block access from these international inspectors, and they haven't tampered with the site, which is what the U.S. has been accusing them of.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov spoke with the BBC, and then he was mentioning the airstrikes that were conducted by the U.S., Britain, and France, and he repeated what has been seen as a Russian assertion that two-thirds of the more than 100 missiles fired into Syria failed to reach their targets. And he also said that the communication between Russia and the West is at its worst point since the Cold War. There seems to be increasing division there between Russia and the West.
That's certainly true. Yes, I mean, in this interview, he once again guaranteed that Russia hadn't tampered with his chemical weapons site. But in terms of just the wider Russian-West or Russian-U.S. relations, of course, Lavrov was saying that, look, this is basically that any ounce of trust that existed between them is almost gone at this point. In terms of, you know, these charges, all this whole story with Syria has kind of broken down into parallel universes, frankly, where you have the Western U.S. and its Western allies saying one version of events, which is largely based on what they hear from rebel groups on the ground and from international observers. Then there's also what the Russians and the Syrian government say. And so whether we're talking about the use of chemical weapons, they split completely on that issue, or even these airstrikes where the U.S. Defense Department says they hit with precision and all these targets were destroyed. And then you have the Russians and the Syrians saying that, in fact, they managed to knock nearly 75% of them out of the sky using Soviet-era air defense systems. And so it's, once again, this kind of strange divide that we've seen in the Syrian saga the whole time.
Well, later today, the U.S. is expected to unveil new sanctions against Russia. This has not happened at the time we are speaking, but what have been the indications in Moscow, the reaction of this?
Well, they're not happy about it, that's for sure. They're promising that they'll come with counter-sanctions once they've had a chance to sort of assess these latest round. I mean, keep in mind, this new round of sanctions, should it be forthcoming, and we think it is, certainly the Trump administration seems to indicate they will announce these today. And this will be the third round of sanctions in the last month, so this time aimed at Russian companies who support Assad's chemical weapons program in any facet.
Charles Maines reporting from Moscow. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's going on?
Well, Sarah, I thought I would give you and our listeners a bit of a treat today.
Okay.
And that means I'm not going to talk about Russia at all. Actually, today, a big hashtag that's trending right now for various reasons, but not necessarily the reasons that you and I might be thinking, is hashtag tax day. Now, for years and years and years, April 15 was the day that all American residents, citizens, had to pay their federal income taxes and their state income taxes. And, of course, yesterday was a Sunday. There is no mail service on Sunday. The government offices are closed. So I just assumed that everything would roll to Monday today. Actually, part of the tax reform measure that was passed recently pushed tax day. Now, I don't know if it's for this year or permanently, but now it's April 17. So if you haven't got your taxes in yet, you still have a day to do it. You can get it done tomorrow. But lots of people still talking about taxes because lots of people like to, you know, talk about taxes or complain about them, depending on the case. Gabe Ortiz writes this on tax day: your friendly reminder that undocumented immigrants pay nearly $12 billion in local and state taxes annually and have contributed $100 billion to the Social Security Fund over a decade. I don't know where he gets his statistics from, but I'm sure there are lots of tax analyst think tanks that would be willing to look at that. Jay Rayling writes with a different viewpoint: why is the Republican position that dying for your country is an honor, but paying taxes is a burden? Hint, who is doing the dying and who is doing the paying? ? Answer that, and I think you've got it. I've been thinking about that, and I still don't have it, so I'm not sure what. Here are the House Republicans sending out a a nice little video. It's like about a minute 10 video, essentially saying soon we'll be saying goodbye and good riddance to our old and outdated tax code. And what they're saying is, you know, goodbye to things that left us too early. And there's lots of sentimental clips. I'm looking, here's John Wayne, there are the Beatles, there's Audrey Hepburn. Next year, as part of, again, this big tax measure that was passed, our tax filing procedure, they say, the Republicans say, is going to be greatly streamlined. So we're not going to have necessarily all the things that we have to worry about that, you know, have kind of just bedeviled people filing their taxes year in, year out. And finally, here's the Treasury Department. One day until tax day, so that's tomorrow. Thanks to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, businesses will pay historically lower rates so they can reinvest in their companies, create jobs, and give their workers a raise. So we'll see what happens with that. But again, I don't know how much this has relevance to our listenership, but if anyone out there hasn't paid their taxes yet, you still have, well, less than 24 hours to get her done.
Okay. Make sure you do that then. Okay. Thanks a lot, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. South Korea's former president, Park Geun-hye, will not appeal her 24-year prison sentence. The Taliban rejects the Afghan president's call for political reconciliation. A U.S. preacher on trial in Turkey for alleged terror ties and espionage. And eight men accused have pleaded not guilty to the rape and murder of an 8-year-old Indian girl. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
We've heard from various studies that drinking a glass of wine a day or any alcoholic beverage in moderation can lower risks of serious illnesses such as cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and even gallstones. But a new study from the UK's University of Cambridge is contradicting those findings. The paper, published in The Lancet, suggests that weekly drinking of more than 5 pints of beer, 5 glasses of wine, or 5 drinks with a maximum of 100 grams of pure alcohol was linked with a lower life expectancy. The study authors found drinking any more than what was suggested increases the risk of stroke, fatal aneurysm, heart failure, and even death. Researchers suggest having 10 to 18 drinks each week lessens life expectancy by between 1 to 2 years, and 18 drinks or more shortens life expectancy from 4 to 5 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at Western films about Russia. A 32-year-old Russian investigative journalist died on Sunday, and some observers believe the death is highly suspicious. Maxim Borodin died after falling from his apartment in Yekaterinburg. I spoke with Johan Beer, the head of the Eastern Europe and Central Asia desk of Reporters Without Borders in Paris. He tells me what's known about Borodin's death.
So Maxim Borodin fell from his 5th floor apartment on the 12th of April, and he died yesterday. He died on Sunday of his wounds. He never recovered from the wounds. Maxim Borodin is well-known in the region for his investigative reporting, focusing on the most sensitive topics, especially crime and corruption. Well, he also investigated nationwide topics in recent months, including the use of Russian mercenaries in Syria or polemics surrounding the movie Matilda. So he also got his moments of fame nationwide, but in general, he was investigating local crime and corruption, and he was described by his colleagues as a brave and hard-hitting journalist who would always lead his stories to the end.
Are authorities describing this as a suicide?
Well, for now, the authorities say that they are exploring several leads, but that the crime lead doesn't seem very likely to them. They say that the apartment where Borodin lives was locked from the inside when they entered it. But nonetheless, of course, several aspects make this case a very suspicious one. First, a local human rights defender told that on the eve of the day when Borodin fell from his balcony, he received a call from Borodin seeking legal support as he was afraid of a sudden increase of the police presence in the neighborhood. A few hours later, Borodin called back saying that he was okay and that this time the police did not come for him. But at least this indicates that Borodin was not comfortable and that he was fearing something. And several of his friends and colleagues told that Borodin was beaten up several times in recent months. So this, plus the extremely sensitive nature of Borodin's investigations, especially into crime and corruption, make the case very suspicious, and we urge the authorities to investigate all leads, including the potential murder because of his journalistic activity. So we urge the authorities to conduct a fair and impartial and thorough investigation, exploring all leads, including the possibility of a murder.
There have been a number of Russians that have died in mysterious circumstances, both in Russia and also overseas. This seems to be happening, I guess you could say, with increasing frequency in recent years.
Yeah, well, we, Reporters Without Borders, count at least 34 journalists killed in relation with their professional activity since 2000. This is huge, and Russia has been characterized by a trend of impunity. The overwhelming majority of these 34 murders of journalists have not been properly or thoroughly investigated. This is why in such unexplained circumstances there are always doubts about a potential murder, especially when a journalist such as Borodin have been known for their hard-hitting reporting. Here in this case, it's a bit early to draw conclusions. For now, it's a bit early to tell that it was for sure a crime, but at the very least, it is very important that the authorities make everything in their power to guarantee that the investigation is led properly and thoroughly, and that all the leads are explored, including the lead of a murder due to journalistic activities.
Johan Beer, the head of the Eastern Europe and Central Asia desk at Reporters Without Borders in Paris. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world, and you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Two recent Western films on Russia, one a Hollywood spy thriller, the other an independent historical satire, depict the country's dark political underbelly. How much of that portrayal is an exaggeration for entertainment's sake, and how much is a take from reality? Experts and filmmakers say it's a little bit of both. VOA's Penelope Pulu set out to find out.
From this day forward, you will become sparrows. Weapons in a global struggle for power.
The recent spy film Red Sparrow follows Dominika Egorova, played by Jennifer Lawrence, into a present-day Russian intelligence facility where trainees are schooled in information extraction through the art of seduction. In an interview with The Voice of America, Lawrence defended the sexually charged spy film as realistic and liberating.
I think people feel so empowered. I think that to watch a woman take control of her body and her sexuality and use her mind to win, and she's always four steps ahead of everybody else.
At the International Spy Museum in Washington, curator Vince Houghton is surrounded by Cold War-era spycraft. Umbrellas that can fire tiny pellets filled with poison, fake Russian and U.S. passports, and bugging devices. Houghton says many of these items inspired classic Hollywood spy films and may be still used in some capacity into today's spycraft. But others, he says, like sparrow schools in Russia, are a thing of the past.
Certainly during the Cold War, there were schools that trained women within the Soviet Union to use their bodies, to use sexuality, to gain intelligence. It wasn't just women. The East Germans, so Russian proxies, were very effective at using what we call Romeo spies.
Are we going to become friends?
Today, he says, such practices are frowned upon.
The CIA, you can actually get fired if it's found out that you had a relationship with one of your assets, one of your sources.
So, Houghton says, though Red Sparrow may be an entertaining film, its flawed timeline and two-dimensional characters undermine what could be accurate depictions of Russian espionage and political ruthlessness today.
Take off your dress.
This is a American view or a Western view of the Russians. And that goes back throughout the Cold War and a lot of the pop culture that you see, whether it's Hunt for October or moving to some of the John le Carré films. The idea of the Russian or the Soviet as being kind of a unfeeling. It's designed to create a bad guy. It's designed to create a dehumanized bad guy.
Stalin's dead.
Stalin is dead!
Comedy about Russian politics can also be controversial. The Death of Stalin, an Anglo-French satire on the race to succeed Stalin, brings to light stranger-than-fiction anecdotal stories, such as how Stalin loved to entertain his cabinet ministers till late at night with John Wayne and John Ford westerns, or how many Russians went to bed wearing several layers of clothing so in case they were dragged out of their beds and off to Siberia, they could keep warm.
So, you know, comic response to those events. So I'm not saying at the top of the film this is true. What I'm saying is watch it for what it is, and then when you go afterwards, if you're intrigued, go online and have a look, and you'll be amazed by how much of it happens to be true.
Yanucci says, though his film was banned from Russian theaters before the recent presidential elections there, it has been embraced by Russian audiences who watched it online. He says the Death of Stalin is satirizing the Kremlin and the absurdity of the purges, not the plight of the Russian people. Penelope Vipulu, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs Acting Assistant Secretary Susan Thornton co-chaired the 31st U.S.-ASEAN Dialogue in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, on April 3rd, together with Ministry of Foreign Affairs Secretary General Dato Ramlan Ibrahim of Malaysia. The dialogue included fruitful talks among the United States, all 10 ASEAN members, and the ASEAN Secretariat, and demonstrated the ongoing importance of the U.S.-ASEAN strategic partnership. Representatives of the United States and ASEAN reaffirmed their commitment to the rules-based order and to the ASEAN-centered regional architecture. The United States and ASEAN exchanged views on the free and open Indo-Pacific concept. Participants welcomed recent developments, including the willingness of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea to engage with the United States on denuclearization, but shared continued grave concern about the DPRK's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. They committed to maintaining maximum pressure until the DPRK takes concrete steps towards complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization, and called for full implementation of all UN Security Council resolutions. Participants reaffirmed the need to ensure peaceful resolution of disputes in accordance with international law, including in the South China Sea, with full respect for legal and diplomatic processes. They underscored the importance of countering terrorism and implementing UN Security Council resolutions to prevent foreign terrorist fighter travel. And they celebrated strong economic ties between the United States and ASEAN, looking forward to enhancing economic cooperation through U.S.-ASEAN Connect, the U.S.-ASEAN Trade and Investment Framework Agreement, and capacity-building programs. Both sides welcomed Singapore's Resilience and Innovation theme for its 2018 chair year. Participants expressed the need for states to adhere to international law and non-binding peacetime norms in their use of information and communications technologies, and shared concerns about malicious actors exploiting cyberspace. They celebrated the steady growth of socio-cultural ties between ASEAN and the United States, particularly through the Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative and the Fulbright Program, and welcomed ongoing cooperation on capacity building through the Lower Mekong Initiative, the U.S.-Singapore Third Country Training Program, and other programs. The United States is proud to partner with ASEAN to continue to promote the security, prosperity, shared values, and cultural ties between the U.S. and the nations of the Asia-Pacific.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.